You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of May 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
Corruption.
They like to talk about it, but can our politicians stop it? My guests Kathleen Burke and Matthew Green will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including NATO's activation of a new missile defence station in Romania to predictable umbrage from Moscow, the suspension of Brazil's president and the question of whether the vice president replacing her can avoid the same fate, and...
It could be the future.
It'll all be over by Sunday. Eurovision insists it is apolitical. So how is Ukraine getting to sing about the historical perfidies of Russia? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College, and also Matthew Green, formerly the FT's man in West Africa, Pakistan and Afghanistan, among other datelines, currently the author of Aftershock. Welcome both to the programme. We will start with this.
President Ghani from Afghanistan, someone who's doing an enormous amount to deal with a country that suffered so much from corruption.
Corruption, writ large, is as much of an enemy, because it destroys nation states, as some of the extremists were fighting.
You're saying no corruption?
No.
None?
No. There were some boneheaded decisions.
But no mass corruption?
Not even mass corruption. Not even a smidgen of corruption.
Okay.
There are few more infuriating problems in politics. Nobody is in favour of corruption, at least not in public, but efforts to thwart it appear to be perennially a few steps behind fraudsters as they burrow adroitly through an ever-expanding warren of loopholes. An anti-corruption summit being convened in London this week by UK Prime Minister David Cameron said, among much else, that stopping corruption was vital in tackling extremism. Matthew, on which note to begin with, is there any greater reason to believe that corruption can be expunged than terrorism? Is it a bit like launching a war on an abstract concept?
Well, quite. It's one of those perennial attempts to eradicate something that seems to have been around for a very long time and is in many ways deeply embedded in human nature, isn't it? But it was interesting to see David Cameron singling out Nigeria and Afghanistan as the two countries he described as fantastically corrupt.
Both of which you have worked in.
That must
have accorded you a wry chuckle.
Well, it did, and it brought back some fun memories in many ways of these countries and seeing how this corruption manifests itself on the street level. I mean, and I think this is the point that sometimes is forgotten, is the way that the kind of grand larceny taking place at the top cascades down through the system right to the traffic cop who is constantly pulling you over and shaking you down for a bribe, not because he wants to steal from you, but probably because he hasn't been paid.
Because that's how he makes a living, yeah. Kathleen, Matthew raises a point there. There's been a lot of headlines in Britain in the last few months, especially since the Panama Papers dump, of what might be thought of as the large-scale corruption, the big stuff, the money launderers and, you know, people whose crookedness runs to, you know, fabulous proportions, stashing money offshore. But in developed first world countries, we are largely spared that low-level, street-level corruption that Matthew talks about there. Is it possible to sort of put a finger on how debilitating that is for the development of countries?
Well, just the symptom of, as Matthew pointed out, the policeman carrying you off the road is of the fact that they haven't been paid. I mean, could I ask Matthew a question that did occur to me while he was talking? To what extent do you suppose you could argue, essay question here, that it's easier to get the big guys in this sort of thing than the little guys? Because you know where it's easier, possibly, once you've got the agreement and the way to do it. It's easier to get someone who's taken $15 billion out if you can trace it to a bank that now has to open it than it is to get all the policemen. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, from a technical perspective, that would probably be the case. But the problem is in that the countries such as Nigeria and Afghanistan, are run on a patronage system, so that the political economy of the country and corruption are very closely entwined. So the chances are that person who stole $1 billion is the cousin of someone very important. So to actually find the political will to make those prosecutions is really a much bigger problem than the sort of technical forensic side of finding out who's done what. Most of the time, it's pretty obvious who's responsible for ripping off the coffers. I mean, I remember in Afghanistan a few years ago, down in the south in Kandahar, the sort of kingpin of Kandahar was the president's half-brother, Ahmed Wali Karzai, who was a big ally of NATO. He ran militias on behalf of the CIA and was generally the kind of sheriff of Kandahar. But he was also alleged by the New York Times to be one of the main drug traffickers of southern Afghanistan. This didn't stop the US using him as their kind of man in Kandahar. That kind of case study is just one of the most flagrant examples of how political power and political patronage is really driving so much of this corruption. And I think that's something that's kind of hard often to grasp when you're living in a more developed country where there's institutions in place to stop this happening in such a blatant way.
So are you implying it's not possible to do anything about it?
I think it is possible to do something about it. And that's why I think it's so interesting to see Cameron's moves here in terms of clamping down on money laundering in the UK. Because the big problem in somewhere like Nigeria, the money's being funneled out of the country by the billions of dollars. And it's a lot of it's ending up in London, in properties, in sports cars, and kind of front businesses. And really, I mean, you know, David Cameron came under fire for calling these countries fantastically corrupt in a rather sort of offhand, colonial-sounding way, and perhaps rightly so.
Although rather wonderfully, Nigeria's president agreed with him.
Yes, he did agree with him, President Buhari. And in fairness to President Buhari, he is an austere former general who did run the country and has been extremely keen to crack down and is seen as being beyond reproach as an individual. So it was rather unfortunate to sort of to label Nigeria in that way. But I mean, the point remains that so much of this money is flooding into London. And until now, there's been really very little scrutiny or very little discussion even about doing something about it. And it'll be very interesting to see whether Cameron is going to deliver more than promises on this.
I mean, I guess, Kathleen, the difference is that in a country like Britain and most other developed first world countries, we would think of occasionally the system becomes corrupt, where in less fortunate countries, corruption is the system. They are, as Matthew says, indivisible from each other. In terms of looking at Britain, what have we made of the measures that David Cameron has thus far announced, particularly this measure announced by the UK and several other countries, including, I think, Nigeria, to launch public registers of who actually owns stuff?
Well, it's a start, isn't it, I suppose. But what is going to stop them from putting wrong names on it? Do you see what I mean? That it is a start, and the hope this sounds like name and shame to me. But one real problem is that two of the really great ones, of course, aren't there.
Well, quite, and we
Cayman
also need
Islands
to and also we need to look at how robust our financial authorities really are. I mean, we went through a huge banking crisis only a few years ago, where huge amounts of debt run up by the banks was essentially transferred onto the shoulders of the public, and we've not seen anybody go to jail for that. I mean, you know, we've got a huge problem with the degree of scrutiny and oversight of our own financial institutions, and I think we need to just get a hell of a lot tougher on anybody who's bending those rules and not just let them off with a few fines.
Well, the other side of being the financial center of the world,
yeah,
is that it's the nodal point.
Yeah.
And so therefore, if what would be the financial services authority or whatever could actually have some power,
teeth.
Then you could open up quite a lot here in London.
And you know, we've had huge scandals involving banks, from manipulating the LIBOR rate to HSBC prosecuted for money laundering, helping Mexican drug cartels launder money. I mean, this is corruption with a capital C. And I'd like to see some comfy cells in Belmarsh Prison being occupied.
Well, on that incendiary note, we will move seamlessly along to a case study in what happens when a country goes too long without an anti-corruption summit. President Dilma Rousseff of Brazil has been suspended from office after her country Senate voted to impeach her over allegations of fiddling the budget figures. President Rousseff, if that's still what we're calling her, has dismissed the move as a coup and a farce. All can at least agree on the latter count. The vice president replacing her and much of the line of succession following him are also all on the hook over various corruption charges. Kathleen, President Rousseff is now she's now trying the "I may have made mistakes but committed no crimes" defence. I guess it delayed the inevitable for Richard Nixon. Do we think it's going to work for her?
Well, there's a difference in there. I mean, Nixon tried to contravene the Constitution. You remember that he had his very own personal squad, the plumbers, you know, who acted entirely illegally. And no one has actually accused her of that. It's strange. She does say that they all do it, and they probably all did do it. But that's hardly been, you know, it's called window dressing, for heaven's sakes. Merchant banks do it all the time.
She's not accused of stealing money to enrich herself. The charges are all about the way that accounts were presented in the run-up to elections. In other words, making the national debt look a little bit less painful by getting a few friendly loans from state banks here and there, which is apparently something that everyone does do. And that has a ring of plausibility to me.
It's not her they're going for, in the sense they're going for her party, and they're going to shift the balance of power. You get her, you know, and because the coalition is broken up because Tamer took his party out. He's a slimy little man, I must say.
Are you implying that having a wife 42 years your junior who has her name tattooed on your neck is slimy?
Now, that would probably be a lot of men might envy that. No, it's just that he's, as Andrew rightly said, I mean, he's under charge. The Speaker of the House is under charge. They're all under charge. No one has ever claimed that she was personally corrupt.
Exactly.
Which cannot be said for 25 across the aisle. So I think it's not her so much. She's convenient because the economy is not quite in meltdown, but it's getting there.
It sounds pretty bad.
It's pretty bad. I mean, it's in the sink. Unemployment 9%, inflation at a 12-year high, worst recession in however long it is. Matthew, all that being the case, and as Kathleen rightly points out, the Speaker, I think, has been suspended. It's very hard to keep up with this one. I think the Deputy Speaker is enmeshed or entangled. Does enmeshed outrank entangled?
I know embroiled, I think, is...
Is embroiled worse than engulfed? I think engulfed is the worst. I think it runs enmeshed, entangled, embroiled, then engulfed. Anyway, that all being said, is the sensible course at this point not basically just... I mean, obviously, you can't actually switch Brazil off and switch it back on again, but you can. You could call an early election. Would that be the responsible thing at this point?
Well, I wonder. It sounds like Brazil is extremely polarized and getting more so during the course of this showdown at the highest levels of power. And that's not necessarily a very helpful atmosphere to have an election in, is it?
It's not. Kathleen, every time we return to the Brazil story, which we have been fairly regularly, I do look at the Olympic clock countdown, which I'm starting to think of as time Brazil has to sort this out before the entire world's media descends on the place. They have 85 days. Mm. How bad is it going to be for Brazil's international image? Because up until the last couple of years, this was a country that was supposed to be coming into its own. It was going to be a powerhouse. It was going to be this extraordinary economic engine for the Southern Hemisphere. It was a BRIC country. It was going to be a great sort of example of a democratic transition. If it is still in this state or worse, which is not impossible, 85 days from now, how lastingly damaging is that going to be?
Well, it depends on whether the tube works and the stadia are built.
Or indeed, if they can find anybody actually qualified to turn up and open it.
Well, it won't be her, sadly, because she will not be president, which is, in that sense, too bad, because she was behind all of this. Brazil is very strange in a sense. I have a godson in Argentina, and in the olden days, of course, what they looked at as Brazil, Argentina is growing, yes, but what Brazil had that Argentina didn't have was a judiciary that couldn't be bullied. I mean, what we must also remember is during this whole period when the Workers' Party has been in power, they have not tried to stop any of the corruption charges, you know, and that included a lot of their own people. So what the crucial thing here is going to be, will the new temporary president, actually allow or will somehow these judicial inquiries stop. I mean, that's a crucial thing, is whether Brazil has gone over what was the old style corruption. You have to say that in her favor. She didn't stop it, even when de Luna, her protege, I mean her mentor, was fingered for a bit.
Matthew, for the next 60 seconds or so, I'm going to appoint you counsel-in-chief to President Dilma Rousseff. What is her next best move? Does she play along with and submit to the legal process or tip the table over?
Well, it sounds like she's got to hunker down, doesn't it? I mean, she was the vote to impeach her was made by a pretty wide margin, so it sounds like the time for manoeuvring has passed and that she's been checkmated, at least for the time being.
OK, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Kathleen Burke and Matthew Green. Up next, we will be looking at that missile system in Romania and asking, how are Ukraine getting away with apparently flouting the ironclad terms and conditions of Eurovision?
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Singapore, our bureau chief is Nolan Giles.
I think for Monocle, the news that we're after isn't your ordinary what's big on Channel News Asia kind of news. It's the stories that are a little bit harder to find, the stories that you have to dig a little bit deeper. And the way that the team operates here from the Singapore Bureau is we're often dispatched to different countries in the region, to different cities, to travel, to explore, to meet people, to be on the ground and be in the action and build a strong contact base.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, still with me, Matthew Green and Kathleen Burke. Now, senior US and NATO officials are gathered today at an airbase on Romania's border with Bulgaria to cut the ribbon on a new Aegis missile defence system. Aegis is an interceptor system which launches missiles at other missiles. It seems, therefore, a reasonable enough thing for NATO to have on its eastern frontier. Russia, however, either robustly disagrees or pretends to, calling the deployment a threat to Russia's security. Kathleen, I did look up, which is always fun to do, this story on the website of RT, which gamely attempted to list five reasons why it was a threat to Russia's security. But one of those was they might counter Russian capabilities in a small-scale conflict, which I think is the general idea.
Well, yes. If Romania is caught in it, they have a lot of nerve trying to stop them. It's on both sides, isn't it? Because NATO and Romania say that really it's just against Iran. It's against Iranian missiles can get to Romania and Poland and Czechoslovakia.
Indeed, so.
So therefore, that's quite a vital sort of thing. So in that sense, it's perfectly true. The Americans say it's nothing to do with Russia, and certainly it's hard to know what a few Aegis missiles could do if Russia was really on the romp. What Russia says, of course, is that it contravenes the 1987 intermediate range missiles, force missiles, because that says you aren't to have any that will go between 500 and 5,500 kilometers. So they said that doesn't really accord with what Aegis missiles can do. The point is that Russia is so, well, paranoid's wrong, and I mean she could say she has a reason to be paranoid. Is, I mean, imagine if along the southern U.S. border or Cuba, shall we say,
for example,
the same thing was happening. You can't, in that sense, blame Russia. But on the other hand, you can't blame Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, and Poland, who really wants them. Poland asked for it 15, a year and a half ago.
And there's one due in Poland, I think, in 2018. Matthew, for all the protestations by NATO that this is purely a defensive measure, it's not really anything to do with Russia, et cetera, is there at least a vague subtext of a warning to Russia not to get any funny ideas about Transnistria, for example?
Well, it does. There's no getting away from the kind of the subliminal message that's conveyed by putting any sort of facility
on the border. I'm not even sure it's subliminal. I think it's just liminal.
Yeah, quite. I mean, it's a story that surfaced a year or so ago, but there's been Russian bear bomber jet probing British airspace on a routine basis over the last few years. I mean, that's not a very friendly thing to do, is it? I think, you know, if we're going to have a few moves to go back to the chessboard analogy, you know, if we're going to be moving a few pawns around, then I don't think Russia can complain too much if we decide to put a little missile base on their doorstep.
I mean, on that subject, Kathleen, do you think Russia is genuinely upset by this, or is this one of those things where they're pretending to be upset because they know it's the sort of thing they're supposed to do in the circumstances and because they think it might give them some leverage somewhere else?
They're pushing. Of course they're pushing. They're pushing when they do barrel rolls of their jets 30 feet away from NATO jets flying, or when they zoom over warships, when they take an Estonian agent across the border back to Russia.
Or bomb Western-backed rebels in Syria.
That's right. Well, that I think could be more of a mess. But what I mean is they are pushing to see what they can do. I mean, that's what Putin is trying to do. He's trying to make Russia the major power in that whole area. And you can't do that. And he's trying to scare NATO to see how far he can push it. He sees Obama and thinks, well, they're not going to do very much because Obama's peaceful and so forth. Won't we love it if Trump becomes president?
We will consider that.
Building happening. My fallout shelter under the Dory house.
We will consider that. But yeah, I think we're quite well insulated.
Yeah, this
quite
actually
well
feels a bit. It actually feels a bit like a fallout shelter.
It does.
Studios are like.
It's the lack of windows. I don't think we're technically underground here. However,
well, it doesn't count then.
That is the tricky bit. There is a basement. But finally, tonight, we must ponder something even more serious, which is tonight's second semi-final of this year's Eurovision Song Contest ahead of Saturday's final. Now, actual political controversy is promised tonight, which is exciting for those of us who can remember when quite a lot of the tournament gave the impression of a world war being fought with dreadful pop songs and maladroit dance routines. The organisers have struggled grimly in recent years to expunge political content, but tonight, Ukraine's contender Jamala, she is a Crimean Tatar by origin, will enthral the continent with 1944, a song commemorating the deportation of her forebears by Stalin. Here is some of it.
It could be the future.
Matthew, first of all, Eurovision rules, which I did look up, state lyrics, speeches, gestures of a political or similar nature shall not be permitted. Now, how is she getting away with this?
Yes, a song called 1944 featuring ethnic cleansing, Stalin and mass deportations doesn't exactly sound like the usual fodder for Eurovision entry, does it?
It's not really a subtext, is it? It is merely a text.
Yes, there's no subliminal message here. Yes, it is. It does seem rather extraordinary because it is clearly political to the hilt, especially given Russia's annexation of Crimea and all the grievances that have followed in its wake. I'm honestly baffled. I can't see how the organisers could have allowed this through.
Kathleen, does it matter if people want to use Eurovision to make some sort of political point? I'm all for it myself.
Well, it will keep the rest of us awake, won't it?
Indeed so.
I was struck by the fact, I mean, if you think about it, last year, the Georgian ladies who we don't want to put in, which was meant to be a takeoff apparently on Putin, they were stopped and these are let through. Well, the point is Stalin's dead and Putin isn't. So
indeed,
therefore, it's not dangerous to have Ukraine singing about something that haven't happened 80, over 70 years ago.
And it's not exactly uplifting, though, is it? I mean, we tune into the Eurovision Song Contest. I certainly do anyway, to be entertained and distracted from my humdrum.
You tune into Eurovision to be entertained.
Humdrum routine and the quiet desperation of existence. You know, I'm not sure that I want to be taken back to World War II war crimes. You know, I'm not sure that I want to hear about what happened in 1944, anywhere.
There has been another politically related row at this year's context, excitingly, which has been one about flags, because there's been a rule where you're only supposed to be able to wave at Eurovision either flags of countries recognised by the UN, the EU flag, or the gay pride flag. Now, in Tuesday night's semi-final, the Armenian entry, one Iveta Mukachayan, waved the flag of Nagorno-Karabakh, which Eurovision have decided, okay. And there's also also been agitation from members of national teams who may be Welsh or Sami, who want to wave their sort of sub-national flag, if you will. Is there an issue here, Kathleen, do you think? Or should people just be allowed to sort of wave whatever flag they like?
Well, problem, of course, for a lot of us is that we wouldn't recognise the flags being waved. I must say I don't know the Finnish Sami flag at all, so that would pass
me by. Tune in
on
Saturday.
Yeah, well, keep me back. Are there limits? Will they be? Will every single competitor have a flag? Will the place be draped as though it were in dustcloths?
As opposed to its usual restrained, minimalistic good taste.
That's right, with nothing but the odd sparkly. I so don't care, I must say. But if it makes them feel better, why should... I mean, so Russia gets upset because... or Azerbaijan gets upset because Nagorno-Karabakh, which I can't even say anymore, flag gets flown. It lets off steam in a pretty safe way. In fact, at least it stops the protesters outside.
In 2009, police in Azerbaijan went round to the homes and arrested people who they looked at, whose phone records they'd looked up and discovered they'd voted for Armenia. This was a thing that actually happened. But I mean, it is a hugely tempting arena for making political gestures in, obviously, because millions and millions of people watch it. We may not entirely understand why, but they do. But do any of those gestures, and I'll ask you, Matthew, do you think they resonate? Because I can remember in 2000, I think it was, the Israeli entry finished their song by waving Syrian flags as a pro-peace gesture. Lots of the songs that Spain fielded under Franco were very thinly veiled hymns to liberation. My particular favourite in 1982, the year, of course, of the Falklands War, Eurovision Song Contest was held in Britain. Spain's entry performed a tango, which you have to say was pretty cute of them. Do you think any of these things do actually resonate?
Well, it sounds like. I mean,
apart from with radio presenters looking this stuff up so they can write their script.
I'm always impressed by the level of background research that goes into your programmes, Andrew. I'd just like to say that for the record. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Those are nice examples which we can perhaps sympathise with, apart with the exception of the Falklands, of course.
Obviously.
But yeah, I mean, one person's gesture in favour of liberation may be deeply offensive to someone else. And in some ways, surely this should be a moment where we all come together as a continent rather than trying to aggravate one another as far as possible by flag-waving and other gestures. I think we should leave the flags outside.
I'm massively in favour of agitation at Eurovision. My dream Eurovision is one that just ascended into a massive all-in brawl, like the closing scene from Blazing Saddles, but even bigger. That would be amazing.
Well, if we have more songs based on historical atrocities, then that's probably quite likely to happen.
Kathleen, on the subject of further political controversy that may erupt, Russia, I am informed by our studio manager Chris Chilvers, who knows far too much about this, is the bookies' favourite. Now, if Russia wins, that means next year's concert performance tournament, by tradition, should be held in Moscow. Are we going to
waving flags?
Well,
there.
Exactly. Are we going to face a 1980s Olympic-style clamour for a boycott?
Well, on the other hand, if you go, Russia will be bankrupted, of course. It costs phenomenal amounts. I don't think so. I mean, when push comes to shove, it's a pop contest, for heaven's sakes. And if countries want their people to go, they'll send them.
I mean, Matthew, as somebody who has grown up in a European culture, therefore steeped in Eurovision in a way that myself or Kathleen haven't nearly
steady.
So much.
I think British culture.
Why do you think it endures? I mean, the music is almost invariably terrible.
Abysmal.
Yeah. So why is it still a thing?
That's a very good question. I'm trying to rack my brains for any song that emerged from Eurovision that actually was worth its salt. There must have been something that came out over the decades that sort of raised the sort of stand a little bit.
There was, of course, Just a Little Bit by Gina G, who was, of course, Australian, representing Britain and showing you all how it should be done.
Exactly. There you go. Nationalist sentiment just creeps in, doesn't
it? Yeah, it does.
No matter how much we try.
I can't help myself. I've turned into a flag-waving chauvinist just sitting here thinking about it. We will have to leave it there, Matthew Green and Kathleen Burke. Thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. That is all for today's show, which was produced by Rhys James, researched by Gaia Lutz and Maria Granina. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. There's more music next. 1900, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, and there's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I will also be your host for that. Midori House returns same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.